I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Welcome to Radio Times. Hurricane Irma has turned the lush green landscapes of Caribbean islands into a dirty brown, littered with collapsed structures, foliage ripped out of the ground, fetid water, and debris. Some are using the word apocalypse to describe the devastation on the U.S. and British Virgin Islands, on St. Bart's and St. Martin's, Barbuda, and Anguilla, where residents have faced food shortages and water shortages and worry about where they are going to live and what their future holds. Our guest, Louis Ferre-Sedurny, has been covering the aftermath of Irma for the New York Times, talking with residents about how they are coping, joining us on Radio Times. Louis, nice to have you with us on the air.
Hi, Marty. It's good to talk to you.
You're in Puerto Rico now, is that correct?
Yes, that's correct, but I've been in and out of the American and British Virgin Islands these last couple of days.
Tell us what you have seen.
So on Tuesday, I was in St. Thomas, and as you mentioned, you know, beautiful green landscapes had, been torn down, and the landscape looked brownish. You know, one resident said that it was as if a bomb had been dropped on the island. Basic services were out, water, electricity, telecommunications. I met numerous people who were left homeless. One man still had the same clothes he had when Irma hit last Wednesday. And there was an 18-hour curfew in St. Thomas, which meant that people could only be outside from 12 p.m. to 6 p.m. But curfew was being loosely enforced, and people would break curfew because they needed to get to the supermarkets and to the distribution centers of food to be the first in line to, you know, get water supplies they needed and ready to eat meals. And a lot of them expressed, concern with food shortages in the island.
And we're talking about a week since Hurricane Irma went through, with winds at times up to 185 miles an hour. Hard to just imagine what that felt like, what that even sounded like. Are people hungry? Are they thirsty? Are they living out sort of in the exposed atmosphere environment?
Yes. I mean, a lot of them are. It varies. One thing that really shocked me is everyone I asked, you know, what was it that they most wanted and needed, they said water and also ice. Ice for them was such a sought after commodity in an island, you know, where they're living under a searing 90-degree sun, and they want to quench their thirst and be able to cool their perishables and foods. So they definitely, a lot of them were going hungry, and often I would ask them if they knew what they were going to eat that night, and a lot of them didn't know. They were improvising, but at the same time, neighbors were coming together to share the food that they were able to salvage and get from centers, and they were coming together to cook and share with each other.
Are we talking about a humanitarian crisis?
It's hard to say, but it felt like that on Tuesday. Since then, there has been an increased government response. There's an increase in American military on the ground. And from residents I've talked to, you know, increased payloads of food, waters, and supplies. So it's hard to say at the moment.
Are we talking airdrops? Because I'm assuming the airport, they're not functional. So how are people getting things like food and water?
It's a combination. It depends on the island we're talking about. In St. John, which is an American Virgin Island and was damaged more than St. Thomas, the first couple of days, it was totally inaccessible. Mm-hmm. And supplies were being dropped off purely by payloads. But since then, they've been able to, you know, reopen the ports and boat supplies in. And then from St. Croix, U.S. aircraft carriers have been able to deploy choppers and aircraft to St. Thomas and St. John.
Anyone that has been to one of these Caribbean islands will know that while there are beautiful, luxurious resorts there, there are many poor people living on these islands. Is it the structures, the homes, the buildings that largely used by the poor residents of these islands that have been destroyed?
Yes, definitely. I mean, I visited one of the most hit housing projects, and, you know, I met a woman who was sitting in her couch, and behind her, where her wall was supposed to be, there was no wall. It was the landscape of St. Thomas behind her, and people were living in buildings where in rubble, some of them. A lot of resorts were hit hard, visibly hard, and, you know, a lot of people are worried how these islands are going to reconstruct long-term. They mostly depend, as you said, on tourism, and that's going to be the main challenge for these islands.
You're in Puerto Rico. Puerto Rico did not get hit as directly as some of these other islands, but nonetheless, there are some pretty serious infrastructure problems. Can you explain what's going on there?
Sure. So Irma didn't hit Puerto Rico directly, as you said, but it still left, you know, over 70% of residents without electricity, a large percentage without water, and it killed a handful. But more than anything, it exposed chronic infrastructure issues in the island, which have been a result of the island's, you know, 10-year economic recession. And political decisions in the past, residents say. So even though Puerto Rico wasn't, you know, devastated like other smaller islands in the Caribbean were, you know, it's been faced with this issue of having to deal with its infrastructure problems.
Well, if we're talking about Puerto Rico, we're talking about the U.S. Virgin Islands. These are part of America. Do they get the same kind of services through FEMA and other government organizations as places in Florida or places in Texas?
Yes, they do. Puerto Ricans and people living in the U.S. Virgin Islands are U.S. resident citizens, and they have, you know, their representative in Congress, non-voting representative. And the FEMA-approved package and HUD package of millions of billions of dollars that was approved for the aftermath after Harvey and Irma applies to Puerto Ricans and U.S. Virgin Islands. FEMA has declared, you know, 10 areas in Puerto Rico devastation zones, which means that residents here that have lost their homes are able to file claims for FEMA and receive aid to repair anything they lost.
So if I'm living on St. John or St. Thomas or even Puerto Rico and I don't have a house anymore, where are these people going?
Well, there are some shelters on the island. I wasn't able to, you know, physically see one of them, but I heard of shelters on the island. A lot of people have been evacuated from the island by the thousands. A lot of them have been evacuated to Puerto Rico. And a lot of them were, you know, sleeping with neighbors, sleeping with other people that were, you know, gracious enough to offer their homes, which hadn't been destroyed. So, you know, one resident said it best, you know, they're in survival mode right now as the government is ramping up efforts to establish basic infrastructure there again.
You described some communication problems, but also, I guess, the creativity of people of trying to be able to communicate with each other. And it sounded like there was even, I believe on St. John or maybe it was St. Thomas, a radio, if not program, some kind of a radio service so that people could talk to each other and hear what's going on.
Yeah, they've gone back to basics. Radio has become the main source of gathering information over there. There is this one radio station in the U.S. Virgin Islands, this one radio host, which, you know, broadcasted through the storm, even if it was just, you know, playing music to soothe listeners. But since the storm hit, you know, people are tuning into radios to listen to the new, you know, the newest updates from the islands. You know, listeners from the U.S., family members call in from Atlanta, D.C., Miami, sending messages to islanders who have been just left, you know, without communications with their family members in the U.S.
You even describe a young, I think, teenage DJ, rather.
Excuse me?
You described a young DJ, I believe a teenager, who also had a radio show or was talking on the radio. Do I have that right?
I don't believe, no, I didn't see that.
Okay, fair enough. So have you talked to local either government or maybe what's left of some of the tourist hotels about what it will take for St. Thomas, St. John to rebuild? And I'm assuming this would apply to places like St. Martin's and St. Bart's.
Sure. I mean, right now it's about establishing back the basic infrastructure, right? And for government officials in these islands, it's about ensuring first and foremost that, you know, their residents are well fed, are well supplied, and can and have roofs over their you know, over their heads. But in the long run, they're you know, a lot of government officials are saying that it's going to take more than the local government's efforts to restore the tourism industry. It's going to take a lot of help from the private sector and charity as well, which we've begun to see in these islands already.
What about cruise ships? Have they been helping with some of this recovery?
Yes, actually. Cruise ships, one or two, if I'm not mistaken, have been, rerouted to these islands to evacuate, U.S. Citizens. Royal Caribbean and the Norwegian cruise ships were, sent supplies over to St. John and St. Thomas and took out stranded tourists from the islands.
Is there concern about a health crisis? I'm just thinking about, sewage and all this water that probably is filled with chemicals and dirt and gasoline, things like that.
Definitely. Health-wise, one of the first things the government did was evacuate, patients who needed treatment, patients at hospitals. You know, St. Thomas Hospital lost its roof, and they had to evacuate 40 patients from there. Since then, I've heard that it's been, reestablished and it's energized again with power. Mm-hmm. But waste management has become a huge issue for these islands. You know, there's debris everywhere. There's standing water. You have, boat and house debris scattered all over the island, and getting that clean as soon as possible to avoid, as you said, a potential health crisis is of utmost importance for these government officials.
And we're almost out of time here. Are you going to keep covering this story then for the Times?
Yes, yesterday I was in Just Van Dyke on the British Virgin Islands, and I'm writing that story up now, and we'll see. I got a one-way ticket to Puerto Rico, so we'll see how long I'll be here.
Okay, fair enough. And just so curious about how you get around.
I'm in Puerto Rico mainly, but a lot of Puerto Rican boaters have been going to the islands to provide relief and evacuate people from the islands, so I've been jumping on board with them, getting off, reporting, getting on the ground to talk to people, and then getting back on the boat or helicopters back to Puerto Rico to write up the stories and file.
Luis, thanks for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thanks for having me, Marty.
You're welcome. That's Luis Ferre-Sodurny, and he's been covering the aftermath of Hurricane Irma for the New York Times, focusing specifically on its devastating impact on islands in the Caribbean. After this short break, Nicole Krauss is with us. She's got a new book. It's called Forest Dark. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Nicole Krauss's new novel, Forest Dark, is about many things, including a young writer named Nicole, who, like the author, lives in Brooklyn and whose marriage is on the rocks. She goes to Israel to stay at the Tel Aviv Hilton to sort out her life, including her writer's block. It's also about 68-year-old lawyer Jules Epstein, whose parents are dead, who's divorced his wife, has sold his many possessions, and gone to Israel, where a charismatic rabbi thinks he's a direct descendant of King David. He, too, stays at the Tel Aviv Hilton. But that doesn't tell the half of it. Kafka has an important role to play in the story. Mahmoud Abbas makes an appearance. So does Shimon Peres. Nicole Krauss joins us on Radio Times to talk about what she wants to explore in this novel, 7 years in the Making. And, Nicole, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Let's begin with a reading from almost the very near beginning of the book where we meet Jules.
Death was too small for Epstein. In retrospect, not even a real possibility. In life, he had taken up the whole room. He wasn't large, only uncontainable. There was too much of him. He constantly overspilled himself. It all came pouring out, the passion, the anger, the enthusiasm, the contempt for people, and the love for all mankind. Argument was the medium in which he was raised, and he needed it to know he was alive. He fell out with three-quarters of everyone he had fallen in with. Those that remained could do no wrong and were loved by Epstein forever. To know him was either to be crushed by him or madly inflated. One hardly recognized oneself in his descriptions. He had a long line of protégés. Epstein breathed himself into them. They became larger and larger, as did everyone he chose to love. At last they flew like a Macy's parade balloon. But then one day they would snag themselves on Epstein's high moral branches and burst. From then on, their names were anathema. In his inflationary habits, Epstein was deeply American, but in his lack of respect for boundaries and his tribalism, he was not. He was something else, and this something else led to misunderstanding again and again.
I just love that passage. That's how we met. How we meet Jules. Are you attracted to people like this? Larger than life doesn't really describe him.
I'm attracted to them, particularly as a writer, because someone like Epstein allows me to have a lot of space on the page for the whole human range. And when I say the human range, I don't mean just passion and charm and tenderness and interesting thought. I also mean anger and confusion. And in Epstein in particular, what drew me to him was, here is this man who has lived all his life in the realm of the certain.
Right.
He has absolute authority. He is successful in every way. He is absolutely at home in the material world. He's acquired paintings and wealth. And he finds himself at a moment that I think a lot of us find ourselves in, no matter what age we are, which is one in which we say, what if I was wrong? What if I sort of staked my life on these certainties, but they weren't the right ones? And in Epstein's case, I think for him, it's this question of, did I somehow, in my absolute certainty and presence in the material realm, did I neglect this other realm, which I guess we could call the spiritual?
And he goes to Israel to explore that, to try to figure that out, I guess, or experience it.
Well, his parents have died, and you know, that's something that I haven't yet experienced, but I've watched that happen to others. And I see what the unmooring that happens in the wake of that, when the thing that made you is no longer in the world, those people that made you. And, you know, for him, that kind of touches off an unraveling. And he leaves his wife of three decades, and he starts to give away everything he owns. He wants a kind of lightening. And he goes to Israel ostensibly because with the last bit of money that he has left, he wants to do something in his parents' memory.
In fact, he wants to build a monument or a memorial to his parents.
Something, and he doesn't yet know what. So there's an openness to his search.
I'm also 68, and my parents are dead. And there is, when both parents are dead, there is this word that I've heard so many people use, which is orphan. I mean, it's not like we need them, but at the same time, there is this kind of orphaning that happens.
Well, Epstein, you know, in particular, his relationship to his parents was one of deep argument. And at one point he says, never, you know, my parents always taught me to define myself in opposition. Never did they suggest, you know, that one could be sort of creative in that sense. Everything that he was came in the realm of argument where he was successful, where, you know, and then there's this quietness that begins to seep in.
Well, let me have you read another section. And this, I should say, the chapters go back and forth between this young writer, Nicole, who lives in Brooklyn, and also this lawyer who goes to Israel named Jules Epstein. And this is Nicole.
Yes. I had been sleeping badly for weeks. My work wasn't going well, and this left me feeling constantly anxious. But if my writing was a kind of sinking ship, the larger landscape, the sea in which I had begun to sense that every boat I tried to sail would eventually go under, was my failing marriage. My husband and I had drifted far apart. We were so devoted to our children that our growing distance could first be excused, then masked by all the love and attentiveness that were regularly present in our house. But at a certain point, the helpfulness of our shared love for the children had reached a kind of apex, and then began to decline until it was no longer helpful to our relationship at all, because it only shone a light on how alone each of us was, and, compared to our children, how unloved. The love we had once felt for and expressed toward each other had either dried up or been withheld. It was too confusing to know which. And yet, day in and day out, we each witnessed and were moved by the other spectacular powers of love evoked by the children. It was against my husband's nature to talk about difficult feelings. These he had learned long ago to hide not only from me, but also from himself, and after many years of trying unsuccessfully to bring him into conversation about them, I'd slowly given up. Conflict was not allowed between us, let alone fury. Everything had to go unspoken while the surface remained passive. In this way, I'd found myself returned to a boundless loneliness that, while unhappy, was at least not foreign to me. "I am essentially a buoyant person," my husband once told me, "while you are a person who ponders everything." But over time, the conditions both within and without had proved too much for his buoyancy, and he too was sinking in his separate sea. In our own ways, we had each come to understand that we had lost faith in our marriage, and yet we didn't know how to act on this understanding, as one does not know how to act on the understanding, for example, that the afterlife does not exist.
Another beautiful passage from Nicole Krauss's book, Forest Dark. There are several things that I want to talk about. This one is, I thought this was a very loving description of how people can fall out of love.
Yes. I mean, this, you know, this book is in so many ways about the forms that we choose in life, the roles that we choose. Sometimes early on, before we know ourselves well enough, before we know what path or evolution we'll take, and how those forms can grow too small for us, or the narratives that we tell can grow too tight, and how do we find more room in them. And so this is really, you know, marriage is one of those forms, and here we have two people, loving, good people, mm-hmm. who find themselves in too narrow a shape, too narrow a form, that no longer feeds them enough.
And seeing each other love their shared children makes them feel even lonelier, because they don't either feel that love or have that love expressed to them. And it should be said, Nicole Krauss, that you have gone through, I'm not sure if it's divorce yet, but certainly a separation from another writer, Jonathan Safran Foer, and much has been made about, you know, diagnosing your marriage here. This is a character named Nicole, so you are inviting us to at least contemplate what it is you're saying about your own marriage.
Well, I'm provoking questions about the way in which we are so fascinated by and so often prioritize and overvalue what we think of as real or autobiographical or true, when we know very well that actually so much of the story we tell, even about ourselves, is actually a construct, right? You know, so you can sit and tell me about what's been going on all these years
sure.
since I've seen you. And in a sense, it's a narrative made up of memory, which is a creative act. And so this character, Nicole, has only the broadest strokes of my life. She's a writer. Mm-hmm. She has two children. Mm-hmm. And she has this writer's block. But the story begins with her stepping into her house and feeling as if she's in two places at once. She's both here and perhaps somewhere in the house there, again, upstairs. And there is this whole sense in the book of having one life here, but all the other shadow lives we might live. And in fiction, of course, as you know, as a writer, we can explore those shadow lives.
Right.
So this is not an autobiographical story.
But drawn, I mean, clearly it has to be, as a writer, it has to be drawn from your life. I mean, this is not Brad and Angelina in terms of what happened to you, although it's, you know, it has to have been painful and kind of public as well.
Well, I think I'm actually trying to make a point here, not so much about that, which is, you know, when I write a story about an old man like Leo Gursky, right. which I spoke to you about last time when I was here talking about the history of love, it is just, in a sense, it's the same action. It is in the creation of character. You take an enormous amount that's personal and experienced and observed from life. Every writer does. But you also create a character. You, in this act of empathy and imagination, you bring that together and mm-hmm. something becomes whole and real. So we know that in literature there is this parallel world where we have other possibilities, a wider sense of life and who we are, and that's different from this reality that we are in now, talking to each other. And so I'm inviting the reader to consider that, to consider that in her own life as well, the ways in which we can expand the story of ourselves so that it fits us better, so that it's not so limiting.
Nicole, in this novel, has writer's block, I guess, for lack of a better word. But she doesn't believe what it is that she's writing. I think that's how I interpreted it. It didn't feel true. And it felt as if what she wanted to say, the words could not contain it. Is that something you've experienced yourself?
Well, I think so much of what she's thinking about early on is that way in which, you know, like we so much need narrative in our life. We need coherence, yeah. right? And because the human brain needs it. Anyone who's read, you know, a book by, I don't know, Oliver Sacks knows that even the most damaged brain will find a way to create coherence so that the self has this stability, you know. But that, you know, that is a kind of construct, you yeah. know. And I think what Nicole is struggling with is she's a writer. Her job is to create order and narrative, to tell a sensible story. But she also knows that there's some truth about life, how chaotic it is, and how many things are conflicted and disordered, that every time you tell a narrative betrays that one truth, the truth of the chaos. And so she's sort of struggling with, how can I let that into my work? How can I allow for that authentic presence so that it feels more true?
You write more and more. It felt to me that in the things I wrote, the degree of artifice was greater than the degree of truth, that the cost of administering a form to what was essentially formless was akin to the cost of breaking the spirit of an animal that is too dangerous to otherwise live with. I mean, that's such a powerful image of breaking the spirit of an animal.
Yeah.
I mean, almost the impossibility of writing.
Yeah, and that animal being all the wildness and all of the infinite possibility of how we can look at things. How can we look at ourselves, the world around us? And we often choose one way, you know. But again, as a writer, you know that there are kind of infinite possibilities.
Sure. Well, are you also saying that that we can be the writers of our lives and that we can create our own selves as a kind of a character?
Not only do I think we can, I think that
we do.
It's just a question of how conscious we are of it. And I think that's what this book wants to encourage in some senses. You know, from the very beginning of our lives, it's like our mother or father says to us, you are like this and your brother is like that. And the story starts there. And you get all these reflections back.
You're the smart one. You're the athletic
yeah.
one. Right.
And you know, get reflections back by those who love you and those who don't, and your, you know, friends and your teachers. And all of that, combined with your memory, this creative act of editing your life and stringing together these singular moments which you've shaped, you know, with the passage of time, all of that is imaginative, is creative. And so I'm saying that as a kind of foundational idea. So mm-hmm. it isn't just like we could be writers. We actually are, you know. And so why not think about that more up on the surface of our lives, to give ourselves more freedom, more room in how we tell our stories.
Both Jules and Nicole escape to Israel. They both stay at the Tel Aviv Hilton. You include a picture of the Tel Aviv Hilton in this book. I mean, just the most, I will say, boring, generic hotel structure that there is. So I look at that, and it means nothing to me. But for Nicole, for Jules as well, but for Nicole, and I think for you as well, this building has a lot of meaning.
Yeah, I almost wish we could somehow have a visual of it, because it's which one can never do in radio. And yeah. but I can describe it, which is just this huge monolithic block. It's this huge grid, and it's cantilevered over the shore of the Mediterranean in Tel Aviv. And yes, you look at it and you think what one thinks often of architecture, which is it's so imposing and it seems to want to direct and shape how we are going to move through it, right? And yet for Nicole, it is actually this place that she associates through all of her childhood. She probably was conceived there. She's been going there all her life. And for her, what's moves her about it, what draws her imagination to it, she imagines she might be able to set a novel there, is this nature of these sort of almost mystical things that have happened to her there. So it almost becomes for her this portal to this other flexible world.
And yet hotels are so anonymous in so many ways. And yet for her, it's filled with meaning and possibility.
And memory. And she tells a story of how once when she was seven, she was sort of diving in the hotel swimming pool because her brother and she were finding all this money scattered. The brother diving for coins. And one afternoon, she just wants to make her brother happy. And so she tells him, something's down there. Dive right here, because she's the pointer and he's the spotter and he's the diver. And she knows there's nothing there. She knows she somehow betrayed him. She feels guilty. And he goes down and he comes up. And she can't possibly explain this, but in his hand, he uncurls his fingers. And there is this earring, this beautiful, real diamond and ruby earring. And her mother marches them through the lobby. And they take it to the jeweler. And he says, yeah, this is, you know, it's real. And she says, but only I knew how very unreal it was, how I had almost willed it into existence, you know. And so for her, the place has this kind of potentially mystical quality.
Almost up on a break here, but is this true for you? Does this hotel have meaning for you, Nicole
Yes,
Gross?
Yes, it has. It's actually where I've been going since I was a child. My parents married there on the terrace of that
hotel. Were you conceived there?
I'm not sure I know for sure, but I suspect so.
Oh, you suspect so. Well, let's take a very short break. We're talking with Nicole Krauss. She's got a new book, a novel. It's called Forest Dark, and she's the author of a number of other novels as well, including Great House. That was a finalist for a National Book Award, The History of Love. Her very first novel, Man Walks Into a Room, was a finalist for the Los Angeles Times Book Prize. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. You can join us, 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe, talking with novelist Nicole Krauss about her new book, Forest Dark, about many things, including a young woman who's a writer whose name is also Nicole. She goes to the Tel Aviv Hilton, to Israel, to sort out her life. Also about a lawyer, a 68-year-old lawyer named Jules Epstein, or Epstein. He, too, has gone to Israel. He, too, stays at the Tel Aviv Hilton. And in many ways, this book is about escape, transformation, all of that. And again, you can join us. It's hard to kind of describe all of this stuff in a coherent way. You can call us and join the conversation at 1-888-477-9499. Is it about escape? I mean, in a sense, you've got a younger woman, an older man, wanting to do something different with their lives.
Absolutely.
Go somewhere to get out of their selves, I guess.
Absolutely. It is very much about escape for me. And I think, you know, that's part of why Kafka began to sort of slide into the book. And he appears almost as a kind of third ghost story in this novel. What fascinated me about Kafka, so Nicole meet when she goes to Israel. One of the things that happens to her, first of all, she's met by a man who is either a former Mossad or a former professor of literature at Tel Aviv University. We never quite find out. But he has something he wants. He wants Nicole to do, and he takes her on this walk to Spinoza Street in Tel Aviv. Anyone who maybe is sort of following this story will know this, but on Spinoza Street in Tel Aviv are all of the papers of Kafka that were unpublished, that were in the suitcase that Max Brod, the executor of his estate, brought out of Prague in 1939 as the Nazis were coming. He was in the last train. He made it to Palestine. Kafka had died already in 1924. Right. And from Palestine, Brod began to publish Kafka, and Kafka slowly trickled into the world. And after he died, this, you know, what was left of the suitcase's materials got handed to his secretary and then to her daughters. And so now for 8 years that there was this court case about who these papers belonged to, this, you know, last remaining daughter who has them in, you know, this apartment with like 30 stray cats. you know, Kafka moldering under, you know, these cats resting, or the National Library of Israel. But what interests me about it is that, you know, you can't help but think, like, is it, you know, you stand outside Spinoza Street, there's these bars in that apartment. Is it Kafka that is in this very Kafkaesque way imprisoned in there? Is it us who's, you know, kept from reaching him? And the more I thought about imprisonment and entrapment, the more I thought about escape, really. And this theory that I love Kafka, I've been reading him all my life. I don't think it's possible to read Kafka without feeling that he's an escape artist, that he escaped. And yet the story that Max Brod really has told us, it's passed on, that's now the official narrative of Kafka, is that in a sense he died of all the things that were entrapping him. He never escaped his overbearing father. You know, he died of tuberculosis. He could never really have time to write. But you read his work and you think, oh, no, this is somebody who absolutely escaped. And 100 years later, he still eludes us. We're still reading him. He still matters to us.
The man who wrote Metamorphosis, right?
The man who wrote Metamorphosis and The Trial and the cat, so many beautiful, you know, really works of art. But so I wanted to begin to tell another story of Kafka, an alternate history of escape. And so, yeah, the escape is everywhere in this book. It becomes a kind of mirroring effect.
I was in Prague a couple of years ago, went to the Kafka Museum there, and one of the things that almost haunts me to this day is the sort of raw fury at his father. I mean, it was almost overwhelming.
And it's so interesting because in that sense, again, it's sort of like Kafka has the last word, because I think what we all know about Kafka and his father is this beautiful letter that Kafka wrote, Letter to My Father, which he apparently handed to his mother and she never gave to his father. But it was published years later after he died, and we've all read it. Yeah. And we don't really know what Herman Kafka thinks, because in the end, the writer has the last word, which, you know, is interesting, can fill you with a lot of ambivalence, actually.
One of the things, I think this is Nicole says, or maybe Jules says, many things were possible in America, were impossible in Israel, but in Israel it was also impossible to feel nothing, to provoke nothing, to walk down the street and not exist. It's an interesting juxtaposition there.
Well, Israel made a lot of sense to me to send these searching characters to, because Israel is such a live and urgent place. It is constantly filled with and addressing the most existential questions. And you know, basically it's a society and a culture which is deeply involved in the act of self-creation too, of self-invention. And, you know, it began in a sense out of nowhere, you know, and since then has had to decide what it is, and it goes on deciding that day by day. It's a difficult place. It's a harsh place. It's a conflicted place. But it's alive. It's alive. And so sending them into that atmosphere, particularly Tel Aviv, which is now really a counterculture to, like, the main culture of Israel, that's a place where people are just, you know, in the midst of real argument constantly and passion and discussion and change. And so, the characters kind of begin to absorb that into their being.
That reminds me of the reading, Nicole, about her marriage falling apart. On the one hand, we have Jules, who comes from this argumentative family. I mean, his parents basically fought their entire life together, and Jules is one of those people. But in Nicole's marriage, there isn't conflict. And that seems to be one of the things that drives Nicole and her husband apart. Doesn't connect them somehow.
Because I think that, you know, fundamentally, when we seat ourselves in front of the other, whether that's the other is our husband or wife or our parents, or whether the other is being in Israel and it's the Palestinians and vice versa, there's something that can be very difficult about letting the true news of the other in. Like, yeah. It's so much easier to just decide that we know already. We know. But when we let that news of the other in, it changes us. You know, it has to change our mind and our hearts. And that, you know, it can be difficult. But when it happens, it can feel violent, but it seems so necessary to me. And so she is yearning for that sense of opening to the other, whatever will come into her.
There's a scene also with Nicole and her husband where they're sleeping back to back, and what that says about, I guess, their marriage, their inability to cross that chasm between the two of them.
I think it's such a common thing in, you know, parents who are engaged with a deep, constantly demanding work of raising young children. You know, it's so interesting that you know, marriage is meant to be this house that both holds deep romantic love, and the raising of children is very hard to have, you know, I know very few in which, you know, that is managed simultaneously. Mm-hmm. And so that sense of the children as bringing in the liveness and the here-ness, and then in whatever, you know, time and space is left, there is that kind of sense of almost being lost with the other that you once had so much intimacy with.
Do you feel like you are recovering from your marriage or the loss of your marriage?
No, I don't. I mean, that's been some years now. I don't feel that way, but I feel like this book is about both the pain of leaving behind things as important to us and deep as marriage, but it's also about the exhilaration of change and the necessity of change and the way that it can feed us and grow us. So, yeah.
You're quoted in, I think this is, what is this, Publishers Weekly. This book is about what it is like to arrive at a certain point in your life. You're still young, you're a mother, you're a wife. No matter how intelligent you are, no matter how many books you've read, there are other choices. You find yourself in a place where you are absolutely limited by these roles. A break is needed, and you go on from there.
Yeah, I just feel like life is so large. I want to live it to its fullest. And I feel like I'm so lucky to be a writer that I get to do that on the page constantly. You know, more characters, more stories, more places. But it also matters to me in life. And I suppose I am somebody who needs, you know, more than one, like the rest of us, you know. I'm eager to just be alive and to see.
Let me see what David from Flemington has to say. David, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Oh, thank you. Really enjoying this. I just wanted to say from my heart, I've never known anyone, including myself, who went to Israel whose life wasn't significantly changed by it and often permanently. And thank you for letting me enjoy the show.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you. Thank you, David, for calling into Radio Times. I'm curious, too. You were, when you first started out writing, you were granted as one of the best young novelists. The New Yorker said you were one of the 20 writers under 40, you know, that people should keep an eye on. So you're no longer a quote-unquote young novelist. Does that feel freeing for you?
I was just going to say thank God for that.
Thank God for that. Someone to keep an eye on, right?
Yeah, well, you know, it's such a strange shift to go from writing for oneself as a young, very young person. I started to write when I was a teenager, which I don't think is unusual for a lot of writers. And there's so much freedom in it. You know, there's so much playfulness and pleasure in all of what you can do on the page, you know. And then when it becomes professional, many, many other layers of expectation from the outside and from within, you know, begin to kind of way. And
to feel like a burden,
the burden of, you know, of having to deliver something rather than simply to do, I think, what writers do best, which is try to get as free as possible on the page and try to explore. You know, is writing novels as I know it is delving into the unknown, and you sit for a long time in that kind of uncertainty and you ask questions, and that can be very anxious. But, you know, if when you're doing it alone before you're published, it's more comforting than when you feel, oh, right, there's this audience. So I think that, you know, there was a moment between maybe Great House and now writing this book, Forest Dark, where I felt I really want to find that playfulness again and that pleasure. It is so important, and I want to keep it all my life as a writer. And so how can I shore it up, and how can I do that?
I know you took the title from Dante, but I was also thinking about fairy tales and dark forests. I mean, obviously switching the words around in your title, but in many ways, these two main characters are sort of a Hansel and Gretel, you know, going, that's not exactly a dark forest, but maybe Little Red Riding Hood or whatever, that there is something kind of fantastical, fairy tale-ish.
I think you're absolutely right about that. I think of the forest as the place traditionally in our imaginations, in literature and art, where we go to get lost, where outlaws live, where magic happens, where mystery happens. In a sense, it's like it's the opposite of the city, which is a reflection of rational human order. And in the forest, we sort of we enter into the unknown. So there are those lines of Dante about, you know, midway through the journey of my life, getting lost in the forest dark and the straightforward path having been lost. But this is not a novel about staying on the straightforward path.
Not at
all. It is a novel about getting lost.
I'd like you to do one more reading, and this is Nicole talking about dance.
That evening, I went to a dance class held in an old yellow school whose window frames were painted sky blue. I loved to dance, but by the time I came to understand that I ought to have tried to become a dancer instead of a writer, it was too late. More and more, it seems to me that dancing is where my true happiness lies, and that when I write, what I'm really trying to do is dance. And because it is impossible, because dancing is free of language, I am never satisfied with writing. To write is, in a sense, to seek to understand, and so it is always something that happens after the fact, is always a process of sifting through the past, and the results of this, if one is lucky, are permanent marks on a page. But to dance is to make oneself available for pleasure, for an explosion, for stillness. It only ever takes place in the present. The moment after it happens, dance has already vanished. Mm,
another beautiful passage. You dance, don't you?
I do. I love to dance. The dance that I do most, that I've been doing for about 7 years now, is called Gaga. Nothing to do with Lady Gaga.
Oh, Gaga. Gaga dance.
Gaga.
Okay.
It is a dance investigation movement language developed by Ohad Naharin, who is an Israeli choreographer. He's the director of the Bat Sheva Dance Company. And to my mind, I think just one of the great choreographers of our time. And I fell in love with his work, and I began to know him, and I would sit in on the rehearsals, and I understood that this dance technique was central to the creation of his work. And what it simply is an hour. It's for people, too. You don't need to be a dancer. It's just an hour of movement led by a teacher who you are improvising, and he or she is leading you with language. And a really good Gaga teacher will have metaphors and will have, you know, ideas for you. But it really is just like writing, actually. It's a kind of exploration, a physical one. But we all know that our emotions are really in the body, right?
Yeah,
they arrive to the mind very, very late. And so it is exploration of the physical and the emotional. And as I said, it's very freeing, and it is very much about play and about pleasure and discovery. And that became very important to me in my work. And so now there are these wonderful Gaga classes in New York. For all I know, they're here in Philadelphia.
I'm going to check them out.
Yeah.
So it's, do you, and we're almost out of time here, but do you wish you had become a dancer instead of a writer, as Nicole writes here?
I sometimes do, and I think, and by now, of course, my career would be over, because it's hard for dancers to keep dancing as time passes. And then I could have become a writer, but I think I'm happy with writing, and I feel lucky to be able to do that and to dance when I can.
Well, I'm happy and lucky that you're able to write as well. Nicole Krauss, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Her new novel, Forest Dark, has just been published, and she's also the author of Great House and The History of Love and Man Walks into a Room, and she started out writing poetry before turning to fiction. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about the program, including how to download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trine Nuri. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thanks for joining us.